Welcome to the podcast of the City Club of Eugene, Oregon. The City Club builds community vision through open inquiry and is dedicated to enabling an informed public on a wide range of topics. Coming up in today's program.
Participation in research is a vital part of the undergraduate experience at the university. Each year, hundreds of students from across academic disciplines can be found investigating, discovering, creating, and innovating.
We appreciate the sponsors who make our civic work possible, including Kaiser Permanente, kp.org, Lane Community College, lanecc.edu, Peace Health, peacehealth.org, the University of Oregon, uoregon.edu, and generous support from Lane County and the City of Eugene. And here's today's program.
Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's May 13th, 2022 program, UBO Women in Science, the annual celebration of undergraduate researchers. My name is Kitty Piercy, and I'm the City Club president for a short time more, and very proud to be so. In today's forum, Women in Science, the annual celebration of undergraduate researchers, you can look up the biographies of our speakers today on cityclubofeugene.org. And now I want to thank Mary Layton for coordinating today's program. And here's Mary to introduce you to our speakers.
Do pigs have a proper role to play in filbert orchards? Is the arrival of a Whole Foods store the cause or the result of gentrification? Does a technological miracle of modern science work as miraculously in Africa as in Oregon? What kind of public health messages increase willingness to follow COVID-19 mitigation procedures? In recent years, we have heard these and other interesting questions answered in City Club programs by University of Oregon undergraduates. Participation in research is a vital part of the undergraduate experience at the university. Each year, hundreds of students from across academic disciplines can be found investigating, discovering, creating, and innovating. Research experiences allow students to explore and clarify their academic and professional goals while developing critical thinking and important workforce skills. The Undergraduate Research Opportunity Program, managed by the Office of Vice President for Research and Innovation, encourages and supports undergraduate research and creative scholarship in all the academic disciplines included in the university's 8 undergraduate schools and colleges. The program promotes inclusive excellence by working to ensure equitable access to opportunities, benefits, and resources to all students, faculty, and staff. Undergraduates engage in serious work, apprenticed to serious researchers in studies of importance to all of us in the state and maybe on the planet. This year, 4 students, all women from the Clark Honors College, will describe what they are doing. They will remind us that college life is not just about sports and partying, though we may recall those things had a role in our own experience, but is for many, if not most, a place to invest adult intelligence, sharpened by education and mentoring, in meeting very big challenges. Be warned, you may need Google Translate. These are very smart cookies. We will hear first from Sanjana Basak, a sophomore, majoring in biochemistry and a member of the Ambati Lab at the Knight Campus for Accelerating Scientific Impact. She is a 2022 Knight Campus Undergraduate Scholars Fellow, 2022 Goldwater nominee, and 2021 First Year Research Experience Award recipient for her research work in ophthalmic biochemistry with faculty members Dr. Bala Ambati and Dr. Hironora Uhara. Her work involves developing a targeted gene therapy for treating late onset Fuchs endothelial corneal dystrophy, a genetic disease that results in loss of vision. Specifically, Sanjana examines how the recombinant endonuclease optidicer cleaves CUG RNA accumulation in corneal endothelial cell nuclei. Outside of the lab, Sanjana enjoys watching shows, baking, reading, and taking long walks when the sun is out. Sanjana?
Thank you very much for the kind introduction. As she said, I'm Sanjana. I'm a research assistant at the Embody Lab. Our lab exclusively researches eyes, but I specifically study the cornea. As a review, the cornea is the outer layer that refracts light to focus vision. It's also a barrier against germs and dirt. And specifically, I researched the corneal endothelium, which is a structure within the cornea. This is a single layer of cells along a structure called the stroma that pumps excess water. So that information was relevant because I study a disease called late onset Fuchs dystrophy. This is an inherited disease that affects the corneal endothelial cells. When these cells die off, they damage the pumping function that pumps out excess fluid, and it leads to corneal swelling, clouding, and significant loss of vision. Don't worry, you're not in danger of this disease. As I said, it's inherited, and it only affects 4% of the U.S. population. Nevertheless, it's a very painful disease, so that's why we're interested in studying it and treating it. So there is early onset and late onset Fuchs dystrophy. What's special about late onset is that there's an expanded trinucleotide sequence, specifically CTG, and this leads to an accumulation of CUG, cytosine, uracil, guanine, RNA in the nucleus, and this is toxic to the cell and it causes the cells to die. Furthermore, RNA splicing is disturbed when there's this RNA accumulation. So our approach to solving this RNA accumulation that's toxic to the cells was to try to modify a protein that already exists to fix this problem. There's a protein called Dicer, and it is already known to cleave or cut long CUG RNA. And what we did is we modified this protein so it cannot receive negative feedback. So when the body tells it to stop cutting, it won't do that. It just continuously cuts. And our question was, can it effectively reduce long CUG RNA accumulation and save cells from dying? Here's just a little more information about what it looks like compared to the original protein. As you can see, it's significantly smaller. This helps as we introduce it to cells. So our methods for testing Optidicer was to introduce it into cells affected by Fuchs. And then we saw the effects and how the treatment was working with a procedure called hybridization. So this is a common procedure and is used to detect trinucleotide repeats. So we could see if the treatment was affecting that long CUG repeat. And there's this RNA probe. This is a little specific, but when it sees that CUG RNA repeat, it will fluoresce. And if you're accessing the slides right now, they are available online if you wish to see them. You can see that the CUG RNA accumulations show up as these red fluorescents. On the photo that says control, these are the cells affected by Fuchs, and there's a lot of these red fluorescence. And then on the other picture that says Optidicer, we've introduced the treatment. And hopefully you can see that there's way less of these red fluorescence. And so we concluded that CUG accumulation was significantly reduced by this treatment of Optidicer. And we're hoping, we haven't tested this yet, that Optidicer may correct RNA missplicing and hopefully restore lost function of Fuchs cells. And this would be very valuable to the scientific world because the only way to treat Fuchs dystrophy right now is through corneal transplantation. And this is a very painful procedure, and recuperation is not always successful. And so we're hoping that we can provide a non-invasive, significantly less painful way to treat this disease. Thank you.
Next up is Carly Fear, a senior majoring in biology and minoring in chemistry. As a member of the Hosenaday Lab in the Knight Campus for Accelerating Scientific Impact, Carly leads a project entitled Protein Design for Bone Healing. Funded by the University of Oregon Vice President for Research and Innovation Fellowship and the Knight Campus Undergraduate Scholars Program, Carly's research focuses on improving bone fracture healing by applying biochemical principles. Specifically, she engineers proteins with a variety of methods to control the capture and release of molecules that direct healing from customizable materials. Outside of the lab, Carly is dedicated to making scientific research accessible to her peers at the University of Oregon as the co-founder of the Scientific Research Society and a peer mentor in the Affiliated Students for Undergraduate Research Engagement. In her free time, she also loves to kayak, hike, and paint birdhouses.
Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. It's lovely to be here, and I'm super excited to talk to you all about my research. As was mentioned, my name is Carly, and I am an undergraduate researcher in the Hosenaday Lab at the Knight Campus for Accelerating Scientific Impact. And specifically, my work revolves around protein design for bone healing. So what does that mean? And I like to point out that bones typically heal relatively well on their own. So bone healing progresses through stages of inflammation, and then bone growth, and then bone remodeling, to finally result in a nicely healed bone that is able to withstand whatever kind of activities that you want to do. And so that takes usually a matter of months, and the process goes smoothly. However, in some cases, time does not heal all wounds. So for 10% of fractures, the result is called non-union. And this is a condition where the bone actually will not completely heal or bridge on its own. It needs further medical intervention. And so that's where my work steps in, trying to figure out how we can get these bones to finally heal. So zooming in a little bit on what results in that healed bone, I like to think about it as a diamond. And there are four sides that contribute to bone healing. These four sides are encapsulated by cells, matrix, proteins, and motion. So cells are those bone-forming cells. Matrix is essentially the gel-like. Most bones heal on their own, but some do not, unfortunately. And when those bones are not likely to heal on their own, we can come in knowing that there are four sides that we can approach: cells, matrix, proteins, and motion. And specifically, my work looks at the proteins side of this diamond. And my favorite protein is bone morphogenetic protein 2, or BMP2. It's this wonderful butterfly-shaped protein that has osteoinductive or bone-forming properties. And so the goal of my work is to be able to deliver BMP2 to bone fractures that are unlikely to heal on their own. And the setup would look something like this. We would apply this bone morphogenetic protein, or BMP2, to a construct or a scaffold, apply this into a large fracture that is supported mechanically, and then hopefully watch healing. And in order to do this, we really need to have fine-tuned control over how quickly and where BMP2 is released. Otherwise, we might get abnormal bone growth. And so in looking at this problem, I look a lot at affinity interactions between proteins. And the way that I think about this is kind of like magnets. A magnet attracts certain types of metals through magnetic forces. And similarly, certain proteins attract other proteins through intermolecular interactions. And so these intermolecular interactions allow for us to go in and control how quickly and where BMP2 is released into this bone fracture. So a tool that I use is computational modeling in order to do this. And computational modeling is kind of a weird term, so I like to start off explaining it with a metaphor where, say, you're trying to figure out what puzzle piece in a pile matches the puzzle piece that you have in your hand. Well, you could do this experimentally by picking up every single puzzle piece in the pile and trying to match it, right? You could also technically do this computationally. And it works basically like if you were to tell a computer how puzzles work and how puzzle pieces work, instead of relying on harder experimental methods, you allow computers to use mathematical and statistical models to be able to understand the principles of the pieces that you're working with. So instead of puzzle pieces, I work a lot with proteins, and we know a lot about how proteins are made. And so computational models are super useful for figuring out how to design affinity interactions. I start off my design using all types of different protein shapes. So proteins come in all different shapes and sizes, and I like to have a diverse library of them to start with. And these are basically going to provide the overall 3D structure for the affinity interaction. But in order to get specificity to BMP2, I use structural elements called motifs. These motifs are pieces from an actual binding interaction that occurs in the body normally, and we've just borrowed a small bit of that interaction and are then able to do a process called grafting to apply it into these larger, more stable scaffolds. And the result of this is specific binders that are also stable. And this is what is going to allow us to spatiotemporally control BMP2 delivery to a fracture. So looking at a couple examples of what I've worked with, I take my motifs from native interactions of BMP2 with its binding partners in the body. And then when I do this process of motif grafting, I end up with gorgeous binders that make lots of interactions across the BMP2 interface. And these interactions are things like hydrogen bonds that rely on protons, and things like hydrophobic interactions, where basically molecules can have sticky parts that like to interact with each other. And so after generating these designs, I'm hopeful that we can apply these into real live fractures and watch healing improve. Zooming back out into kind of the significance of my work and coming back to that diamond of bone healing, I want to highlight that this has not been a solo project whatsoever. My lab, the Hossein Zadeh lab, focuses a lot on the protein end of it. But for cells and matrix, our close collaborator, Marianne Hediarachi, that is really her domain. And this project has been a huge collaboration with her in particular. And then for the motion side of the diamond, mechanical stabilization and stimulation is really a strong point of Dr. Ketgi Ong, who I've also worked with at the Knight campus. So my work has been incredibly collaborative and, of course, incredibly fun. And I'm just really happy that I was able to share what I've been able to do with all of you today. Thank you.
Thank you, Carly. Our next speaker is Audra McNamee, a senior majoring in math and computer science with minors in comics and cartoon studies. For some reason, this reminds me of a saying I read, you know, like 40 years ago about an education. Those who can teach. Those who can do, those who understand, teach. What we're going to hear next is how someone who understands uses art to teach. So one kind of transformation of knowledge that presumes understanding. And then our last speaker will talk about another kind of application. Audra's honors thesis is called Welcome to Computer Science, Designing a Comic Tour of Computers and Computing. Her research mentor is Kathleen Freeman. Outside of school, she makes short comics for fun. Now listen to this. On topics ranging from the 60-year history of a libertarian billboard near I-5 to an abridged history of Jell-O. Audra, a Portland native, hopes to keep doing projects like this in the future by making educational comics for a living. Audra?
Thank you so much for that lovely introduction. As stated, I am Audra McNamee, and I am going to be talking about a 56-page comic that I created for my Clark Honors College in Computer and Information Science thesis. It is called Welcome to Computer Science. If you are listening to this instead of viewing it, I would appreciate your collaboration with me as we visualize some images together. But of course, you can always see the slides that I'm going to be presenting on YouTube. So to begin, what is a comic? Is it superheroes, like in a beat 'em up? Is it a newspaper strip? I would like to propose one definition of comics from Scott McCloud in his 1993 Understanding Comics. A comic is juxtaposed pictorial and other images in deliberate sequence. I don't know if that helped at all. Kind of stepping back and turning that into words like that make sense. A comic page has multiple images on it that are in a sequence that tells a story through time. For the sake of my comics have words on them as well. And the key way that those words interact with the images is that they are on level footing. The words are as important as the images. They're inextricably linked. Without one, you get no sense from the other. Comics are just a form. They are a way to encapsulate information. You can put anything in them. You can put a superhero story. You can put education about computer science. So knowing that, why do you bother with educational comics? There are not very many studies on educational comics currently, but there are some. And the things that they indicate are that comics are a powerful way of educating because comics are narrative. This isn't inherent to comics, but many comics do choose to tell their information in a narrative form. And this helps keep readers engaged and gives them a way to process information as it builds in complexity. Comics are visual. Perhaps this set of presentations has illuminated to you the inherent visual nature of science. It's very hard to explain science clearly and concisely without images. And so having a format that is natively visual allows the images of science to shine through. Comics are reader time controlled. This is sort of a facet of visual. But of course, there are lots of visual ways of presenting information. One of them is a video. Another is a presentation with visual elements. But these are controlled by the presenter. If perhaps I'm going too slowly and you want me to hurry up, you'd have to like yell at me and make me do that, and that would interrupt the entire flow of this. If I'm going too quickly and you want me to slow down, in a video you could skip back, but then everything would be repeated and you wouldn't, again, get an uninterrupted flow of information. Comics, however, you can read a comic page as slowly or quickly as you would like, and you still get the flow of information as the creator intended. Comics are also approachable. This is partially because of comics' sort of stereotypical existence in our society. They're for children, they're not very serious, maybe they're funny. Because of that, you can put educational information inside a comic, and people who might not otherwise think that they are interested in or capable of engaging with it in a textbook or a scientific article format you can teach them the information and possibly set them on a journey of learning more. However, comics' visual nature also makes them inherently approachable. When you open them up, you're already immersed. You don't have to begin decoding chunks of text. There's other scientifically like positive teaching reasons why comics are useful, dual coding and concreteness fading, but I don't need to explain that now. So comics are good for education. Why aren't there more educational comics? There are a lot of educational comics. Every single educational comic I've read has taught me something. They're all beautiful. There are not, however, very many educational comics about computer science. There are children's like picture books about computer science. There are illustrated zines about computer science. But most of the comics about computer science are either biographies of people tangentially related to the field, or they're children's like comics about introductions to programming. All of these are very useful. They're excellent comics. They teach you a lot. However, there is a real gap in the available comics for a comic that introduces computer science to a high school, undergraduate, adult audience. And that is what I tried to fill. So there were a lot of directions that I could have taken this comic in. I could have done an introduction to programming. However, like this is a common way to introduce computer science. However, programming is best taught by programming. And it's very hard, it's possible, but it's very hard to program on paper with pencil. So programming classes, best left to classes, interactive web pages. The direction I chose to take instead was to introduce the breadth of computer science. So I have an introduction to the concept of computers. I have a first section, which is about computer hardware and physically, what are the components of a computer? How does information flow through a computer? And explaining binary or electrical on and off as the basic movement of information through a computer. I have part two, which is about programming languages, and not about how to use programming languages, but instead how programming languages are built from the simplest commands that a computer understands. Things like addition, subtraction. Computers don't natively understand anything more complicated than that, but complicated programming languages are built from these simple parts. Part three, the final part, is about the internet, because of course, when you're engaging with a computer, it's most likely that you are in some way interacting with the World Wide Web or email or some other connective network. I both explained how information moves through the internet in simple pieces, as well as explaining functionally what like the physical infrastructure of the internet is, what data centers are, where they exist in the world, how they impact the world. And that's what I did. So the comic exists. It's 56 pages. I hope, because of course, I touched on only like a tiny number of topics in computer science, that in the future I can develop this into a broader project. But I am incredibly grateful to the UO Computer Science Department for enabling me to make this. And I am excited to create more educational comics in the future and learn more about what makes a good educational comic.
I'm going to read that book. Our final presenter is Jenna Travers, a junior majoring in marine biology with minors in geography, science communication, and legal studies. She works with Mark Carey in the Glacier Lab, studying the effects of glacier retreat on salmon populations in the Pacific Northwest and the resulting impacts on local communities. Jenna grew up in coastal fishing towns in Alaska and Oregon, so researching the importance of salmons to communities and how they are responding to declines in populations is really close to her heart. Jenna received a Goldwater Scholarship for her thesis, research looking into how dual climate emergency like glacier retreat and salmon declines is framed for communities and stakeholders. In addition to this work, Janet is also a writer with Glacier Hub and a salmon identifying artificial intelligence contractor. All right, I want to know what that means, actually, with the Wild Salmon Center. In her free time, she has free time, I can't believe it. She enjoys hiking, swimming, and backpacking. And for fun, this summer she will spend on field work, in a field work position, measuring glaciers in the North Cascades, which used to take a lot longer than it probably does now.
So hi, everyone. As Mary just introduced, my name is Jenna Travers, and my thesis research and what I'll be presenting on today is about stories of decline, glacier retreat, and salmon shortages. Okay, so I actually forgot that I put most of this stuff in my bio, but just a quick overview of who I am. I'm a marine biology major. I'm minoring in science communication, legal studies, and geography, and I'm planning to pursue a PhD in fisheries management after I graduate. And I'm a 2022 Goldwater recipient. My dad was in the Coast Guard, so I grew up in coastal fishing towns in Alaska and Oregon, so I've been fishing and on glaciers since I was a little kid. And so when I came to UO, I heard about the Glacier Lab and I thought it was really interesting to be looking at glacier retreat and climate change through a societal lens rather than just a hard STEM lens. And so I joined, and my research mostly focuses on glacier retreat and salmon declines. First off, just to start, we know that glaciers are retreating in the Pacific Northwest. There's 35 glaciers have disappeared in the Olympics in the past 40 years. And that's not just they've shrunk, it's they have shrunk so much that they are no longer designated as glaciers. And at the same time, salmon populations in the Pacific Northwest are in a really bad spot right now. In Washington alone, 14 salmon populations are endangered or threatened, and 5 of those are deemed in crisis to the point where if we don't do something now, they may go extinct. And so these two things are connected. Glaciers provide cold meltwater for salmon during the summer months when it's really warm, and they sustain stream flows during those times. And salmon are a cold water species, so as climate change causes their streams to warm and glaciers shrink and no longer provide that water, this is really bad news for salmon. So my research looks at some of the species-based impacts, so how will different species be impacted differently based on how long they spend in streams, their life history, life cycle, that sort of thing. I also look at societal impacts, so how will both glacier loss and salmon loss impact communities in the Pacific Northwest, either through economic reasons, cultural purposes, or ecological. And my thesis actually focuses on the third part of my research, which is science communication. And so I am really curious how these issues and climate issues in general are being communicated to the public. So how do we communicate issues of climate change to the public, and how does the way that we communicate them affect climate action, perceptions, all of that? And so for my thesis, I looked at the narratives and stories surrounding glacier retreat and salmon declines in the Pacific Northwest. And my principal question was, how do these change based on stakeholders? Because I thought things like government and news organizations and environmental nonprofits and indigenous tribes would all have very different ways of framing this issue, and that could lead to some disparities in the way that these are talked about. And so I found 115 sources from 4 stakeholder groups. These sources are all publicly accessible ones, so I didn't go through the 200-page reports because those really are not aimed at the public. That's not affecting public decisions. So I looked at news articles and videos produced by these and newsletters and that sort of thing, interviews. And I read through all of these sources or listened to them and transcribed them for the videos. And I took notes on narratives and themes in each of them. And I compiled these into a codebook, which is essentially just a list, in this case, of the most common narratives that I found. But it's just things like glacier retreat will harm salmon, or glacier retreat is good for salmon in some cases. Salmon are important economically. So I just identified these common narratives, and then I used a qualitative software to go back into each one of those sources
and reapply those. So I would highlight the text that showed one of the narratives, and I would just code it so that I could essentially go back later and count and see how often were these narratives stated, who stated them, why is this important. So here's what I found. It's actually not that interesting. Stakeholder did not have as big of an impact as I thought. There were some really clear trends, but I thought it was going to be this like huge difference between all of them, but they tell a similar story, and there are differences. But what I did notice is that specifically for glacier retreat and how it impacts salmon, every group except for indigenous sources mentioned at least a few times that glacier retreat would benefit salmon or that it would have mixed results for salmon. And this is important because in the far northern latitudes, glacier retreat can benefit salmon. There, the water temperatures are not rising as much because it's still cold there. And as glaciers retreat, they open up new habitat from where ice used to be for salmon. So there are these benefits. And I started thinking, why do indigenous groups, why are they the only ones that don't have this? And one of the things that I thought about was maybe it has to do with geographic location. All of the other forms have some sort of out-of-state, outside of the Pacific Northwest entity in them. So for government, there's federal government. For nonprofits, there are like international and national nonprofits. And for news outlets, we have like the New York Times and all of that. And this ended up being a really clear impact because indigenous sources, all of them came from within the state of Washington. There were no outside sources. And when I looked at geographic location, just looking at in-state versus out-of-state, I saw these really clear differences. So when talking about how glacier retreat will impact salmon, in-state sources almost never bring up potential benefits or mixed results. They are only focused on the harms because that's what glacier retreat will do for salmon. However, in future action roles, the in-state sources focus instead on the future action, whereas out-of-state sources were much more likely to talk about what was currently being done, what could be done, what strategies should be used. And so a lot of this comes down to both audience and priorities. The New York Times is not a great place to tell someone how they can get involved in this, because if someone from Tampa is reading about salmon declines in Washington, they can't go out and restore a stream. Like, there's not that same accessibility. And so the in-state source is really focused on that future action because they are the ones doing it. These state government, these indigenous groups are doing monitoring projects. They are collaborating on different climate reports. They are the ones actually doing this future action and work. And additionally, priorities are a really important thing. So for some groups from out of state, glacier retreat will benefit salmon. In Alaska and British Columbia, it can help. And so by focusing on potential benefits of it, they can know that they need to protect the habitat that will be exposed before it's actual stream habitat. And so there are just these different priorities that come with that. The second main thing that I found is that overlapping climate narratives can transform narratives. And so a lot of times, climate narratives are talked about as sole things. So glaciers are retreating, salmon are declining. Those are separate. And these narratives are actually really important because narratives of glacier retreat tend to be very hopeless. Glaciers are retreating, it's going to hurt communities, and there's very little future action. And when I looked at this, there is almost no way to help. And the reason for that is because even if we stopped emitting all carbon right now, glaciers would continue to retreat. We are past a threshold where a lot of glaciers are going to shrink and disappear by the end of the century, even if we stop immediately. And so this leads into kind of this doom and gloom narrative of like, there's nothing we can do, climate change is gonna just like ruin everything. But salmon decline narratives have a lot more actionable items because salmon can come back. We've seen after removing dams, after creating cold water refuges, that salmon populations can rebound and that they can come back. They're a very adaptable species. And so there's a lot more future action in those narratives. And when we combine the issue of glacier retreat and salmon, we can change a hopeless narrative of glacier retreat into one of action and hope. And we can change the entire narrative around climate change through this by essentially creating, like, this is something bad that's happening, but it doesn't mean that it's like all these communities will suffer. And so this works for all the things that glacier retreat impacts. And it has huge implications for science communication.
If you enjoyed this presentation by the City Club of Eugene, please visit our website at cityclubofeugene.org or our YouTube channel and our social media pages.